So, Bob, we got some really juicy emails. Let's get into it. What do you say?
I say yes.
This email is from anonymous patron. She says, "Hi, Dr. Kirk and Bob. I have worked with my therapist." This is kind of a long email, so we'll kind of chime in as we go. Okay, right. Bob? So we have her saying, "I have worked with my therapist for about 5 years through so many milestones and challenges, including going through my master's program in marriage and family therapy. Since I entered graduate school about 4 years ago, the therapist has offered lots of insight and school career specific advice and quasi supervision mentorship along the way." So just chiming in here, what do you think about that?
I think it's okay. I mean, I don't know what's going on specific, but I have relied on my therapist for some mentorship along the way, I think it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's a common thing.
Yeah.
Therapists in training are supposed to be in therapy
yeah.
pretty intensely in the beginning of their career.
Do they have that requirement?
At Antioch, we added that, yeah.
Yeah, oh, we didn't have to.
No, I think it's a good requirement.
I do too.
But I feel like people should just know to do it.
It shouldn't be like this forced march to it.
Right.
Like, if you want to be a therapist, get your butt in a chair and be a client.
Why would you not want to?
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense that you would avoid it.
Right.
Especially when you're in graduate school, there's so much that's unearthed. And
yeah.
And also, you can see how another therapist acts with you. You can feel what it's like to be a client.
Right.
And it's just logical to me. But anyway.
Yeah.
So... yeah, it's totally normal that therapists in training, one, will be in therapy intensely, and two, might use therapy for mentorship and quasi-supervision. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's well understood. It doesn't have to be that way, yeah. and it all just depends on what you want as a client. If you don't want that, then say, "I don't want that. I want to mm-hmm. work on it. I just want to be thought of as a client, not as a client who happens to be a therapist." Also, some periods of therapy could actually be a majority of that, which is also okay. There's a dual relationship there that needs to be managed by the therapist, not the therapist in training, but mm-hmm. and there has to be explicit conversations about that
yeah.
because there's a line there and the therapist is not the supervisor, not even close. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so going on, I respect this therapist and I think sometimes I blindly follow their advice mm-hmm. regarding career and education. Recently, I have finally gotten to a point where I can feel ready to begin processing issues around financial trauma. So just chiming in. I don't know what she means by financial trauma, but I could imagine what that means. Mm. At the very least, it's a trauma that's related to finances. Mm-hmm. I wanted to focus on the feelings of shame and fear around financial insecurity, feeling so stupid about my lack of math skills, etc. Mm. Oh, okay. Yeah. I've heard this before. I have a friend who is actually, will say similar things that they're very smart, but whenever any financial topic comes up, like saving money or investing or how to budget, she has some trauma that just will completely throw her into this regressive, childish, "I'm an idiot. I'm going to screw things up." I've just frozen in fear almost, you know, yeah. just and needs other people to literally do it for her.
Yeah.
And like I said, she's not unintelligent. She's very intelligent, accomplished.
Right.
You know, yeah. if she were doing finances at her work, she'd probably be fine. Yeah. But when it comes to hers, it gets really, you know, so the trauma kicks
right.
in. Right.
Okay. Right.
Instead, so she's saying, "I'm finally ready to talk about these things and processing and healing for that. Instead, my therapist proceeded to give me a homework assignment, which entailed applying for a balance transfer credit card." Do you know what a balance transfer credit card is?
Yeah, that's when you get those offers in the mail and they say you can transfer your balance of your other credit card to this one for free and like have low or no interest for 12 months or whatever it is. And that's a balance transfer credit card.
Huh. Okay. So what do you think about a therapist assigning homework like that?
I mean, I could see it. We weren't there, so we don't know the context. And the therapist might be just, you know, misattuned in this area where they think that you want X and it turns out you actually want Y. So I don't really know.
Yeah.
I could imagine giving a client of mine, well, I probably wouldn't do it now because that's just not the kind of thing I do. But I've had clients that have had financial difficulties, and we've talked about the nitty gritty of how to get yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm. So, would you give homework though?
I don't know if I'd call it homework. I think I'd probably discuss it, and then we'd reach a, perhaps we'd reach an agreement about what would be the next best step. And I guess you could call that homework. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe in the forced march. I will now tell you what to do, and you will do it, and then mm-hmm. you'll come back and report to daddy, and blah, blah, blah. I don't buy that.
Yeah. Well, the way you're talking sounds a little bit more down that spectrum. But for me, I've always had this policy, and I'm sure that I haven't followed it all the time, but when we go into topics like this, I feel the shift away from what I think is good in therapy. It'll feel pragmatic and homeworky and prescriptive, and although I might have some thoughts, it's so noticeable to me that I'll couch everything in a lot of tentativeness. You know, like if I'm trying to think of a situation, like if someone were to come to me, I'm trying to think of a situation where I would be expected to know about these things, you know, outside of normal therapeutic talk.
Oh, well, that gets a little tricky.
Well, that's what this is. You know, it specifics about getting a credit card. That's way outside of what therapy, like, is.
You didn't take that class in graduate school?
And so if, I suppose, you know, finances, I do know some things.
That's true.
Probably above average, because I've been in, you know, I've had my own business for 25 years and have to pay taxes and budget and expenses.
You have some education in that area, right?
Yeah, and, you know, you live long enough and you have enough Excel spreadsheets of these things. And so
You're a very good money manager.
I mean, I don't know if I'm as good as you are.
Oh, I did not get myself out of grad school debt because of my good effort.
You didn't work. You weren't a workaholic like I was.
You got yourself. I'm glad to be out of grad school debt, but you were just on it, man.
Yeah,
it's like something really admirable in that.
Well, I was balls to the wall. I mean, you, after graduation, how much debt did you have?
40 grand.
I had double that.
Yeah.
So that's one. Two, you just worked at your agency job, right?
I did.
And you and I were trying to get our private practices off the ground.
I wasn't trying that hard back then. But yeah, eventually, yes.
Well, it was hard to know what to do in
19. Yeah, I remember that. Like, how do you...
You remember you and I started an agency.
Oh, golly.
Remember this?
I have vague memory. Do we have a name for it?
Oh, my God. I'm so happy, Bob, that I remember something vividly. So there's a lot of stories here,
dude,
that I'm about to tell you that I'm guessing will ring a bell, but...
Oh, juicy.
Everything in our lives together, you remember so much more vividly than I do. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, I'd say 99% of our memories are shared, but but I'm so surprised you don't remember this.
Okay, so what was it? I'm starting to remember.
Okay.
Keep going, though. Keep going.
No, well, you tell me what you remember.
Nothing specific.
Do you remember what we called our practice?
No, what did we call it?
Did you remember getting cards?
I vaguely remember something like a card.
I think I still have one.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah.
What did we call it?
Delta Counseling.
Yeah, Delta Counseling, right. I still have a Delta on my business card.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Delta, Greek sign for change.
Yeah. It must have been your idea.
Delta Counseling? Yeah, that would probably be me.
We got cards made.
Yeah.
And I think they're vertical, actually.
Do you have it handy?
I mean, I took a scan of it back in the day.
Wow.
So let me just type in Delta into my computer and see what happens. It's working on it. It's working on it. It's searching through everything. There it is. So, yeah, Delta Counseling. Kirk J. Honda, Robert D. Gettle. And we have a little logo there that I don't know who made that.
Triangle, I think we probably got it off the net.
Or, no, we wouldn't have, maybe, but it could have also, back then I would have thought we would have got it from, like, the printer.
Yeah,
They would have had, like, a book with a bunch of shapes and stuff.
Right.
And then I have my email address, which is a worldlink.net, which I'm remembering now it was essentially, it was my internet service provider, and they gave me an email address, and I have this old telephone number, and then I have the address of your office on Broadway.
Down at Capitol Hill, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we were trying to get our practice off the ground, and we were trying to work together to, I guess, market and encourage each other or something.
You remember the chairs?
I do.
Oh, God.
So describe, awesome. So Bob was subletting someone else's office, meaning that an established private practice therapist had an office for a while, and Bob was paying money to use it occasionally because we didn't have very many clients, and then you were letting me use your sublet. So describe these chairs.
So they were made out of branches that were sort of bent and strapped together.
Yeah, and by branches, literally just branches pulled off a tree.
Off a tree.
Like, with the bark and the leaves.
Leaves.
Leaves still attached.
Well, that was the thing, is the backs of the chairs were like 8 feet tall.
Yeah.
Because we had 10-foot ceilings in that office. So they're like 8 feet tall. And at the top, they have leaves still on them. Like, these are just like things that got picked up out of the woods.
Right, and so they must have used some chemical to make the leaves not degrade or something.
Yeah, I remember they were stained and shellacked or you know, urethaned or whatever.
Yeah.
But every time you sat down, every time you moved a little bit, you could hear the woods rustle behind you. It was like just...
Yeah. Yeah, the structure of this... So there was a chair and a bench, right?
Yeah.
And by bench, it's like couch, but with a giant back to it.
Yeah.
And they... It seemed like the sort of thing you would put in a whimsical patio, not the sort of thing you would put in a professional clinical office.
I think it was like this Jungian archetypal stuff, or I don't know what.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. But anyway, so we, as a part of our trying, because the internet wasn't really in existence in 98. I mean, it existed, but people were not, especially therapists, for God's sakes, were not able to capitalize. And very few people even had access to the internet. So we just had to build on word of mouth. And there weren't really, like, Psychology Today didn't, you know, just think about that. How do you spread the word that you're a therapist and you're looking for clients? And it might seem like, well, you just talk with your friends, you go to church and you announce. Take it from me and Bob that is not an effective way of getting therapists. Because the amount of people in your personal contact circle who are currently looking for a therapist that you actually fit the description of is basically zero.
Yeah.
When you're trying to market to the pool of particular, you know, customers, of potential customers, you have to cast a wide-ass net.
Wide net.
And only to get one or two calls a month kind of a thing, even today to some extent.
Yeah.
So back then, we didn't know what to do, but we went to Paul David. Do you remember this?
No.
Yeah, we met with him.
I don't think I ever talked to that guy.
No, you and I went to Antioch, because he was my supervisor, and he was teaching me how to teach. He was, you know, mentoring me, and I was still involved with Antioch, and I probably told him. And he was very encouraging about my practice as well, and was willing to let me use his office, which was a real sweet office in Fremont.
Oh, nice.
And he also supervised me for free in my private practice. But anyway, we went to him to get advice, and he did. He gave us a lot of good advice. He knew a lot about the landscape back then. And I'm trying to remember what his advice was. I think his advice was that we should reach out to doctor's office and psychiatrists and maybe schools or something, and take him out to, you know, coffee and sort of get our card in front of their face with that. And I actually still give that advice to people sometimes.
That is good advice.
Yeah. Like, if you work with, say, children, one of the best allies you can have to your business is to have a principal at a school that, or a school counselor that likes you.
Yeah.
But might even just be, you're the only one they know that has open spots within the neighborhood, you know? So I still give that advice. At least I think that's what he was saying. But anyway, yeah. But so with you and your debt, you just were working at your agency and you were getting $11 an hour, I remember, because I was getting $13 an hour.
Yep.
And you were super jealous of me.
I was.
And even with my $13 an hour and living like still a college student, uh-huh. I had a shitty ass apartment.
I like that apartment. It's so fun.
You couldn't take a shower because the owner, who lived right next door, a chiropractor,
that's right,
refused or prohibited whoever rented, regardless of who it was, and, you know, me included, from taking a because you know they had a regular bathtub that you could absolutely put a shower head and a shower curtain, but I think he was really anal about like water damage or something. I don't know. It's not hard to manage that.
No.
And so I took baths every day or when I needed a bath or something.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, baths can be pleasant and cute when you want to relax or just you want that experience. But when you wake up in the morning, you're rushing out of the door.
Yeah.
Baths are not convenient. Anyway, so I, you know, that's the sort of place I was living in, not ideal.
Yeah.
It was nice for the time, and it was super cheap, actually, was the thing. It was, like, surprisingly cheap. Anyway, so I was like, this cannot be sustained. I need to be working basically two full-time jobs. So I started teaching at Antioch, and started building my private practice.
And you were working with Mary.
What did you do? Like, how did you, because like you're getting paid $11 an hour, you're working 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
How did you pay off your student loans?
Well, over time, I did develop a very small private practice and weaned away from the agency as that grew a bit. And then at one point just left the agency altogether. I think I was working there 3 or 4 days a week. And
like how many years after graduation was this?
2001. So
four years after
4 years or 2002.
So around then you were able to leave the agency.
Yeah. And so, and then I was living with the Todd
and you were spreading your, word of mouth.
I was hooked up with an EAP, an employee assistance program, and they were sending me clients pretty regular. So they said, look, we can't guarantee it, but they continued to send me.
And then they would transition into private practice.
Yeah. Sometimes, not often.
But I did that. I did that for a while too.
It's, I liked it. I think
and even
cool.
The EAP, the low rate that you get paid from that was still more than agency work.
Much more. Yeah. So between those kind of things and then starting the DBT group, I could afford to live without the agency. And then it grew enough that when the Todd said, okay, we're splitting up. And he said to me, I'll never forget this. We're standing in his kitchen. He's like, you should buy a condo. I'm like, I don't know nothing about it. So anyways, I got a real estate agent and blah, blah. So I bought a condo that I could just afford.
He was always good with investments.
Good guy. And I lived in that condo from 2004 till fall of 2005.
I drive by there all the time. Wait, you only lived in that condo for a year?
Year and a half.
That's bizarre.
Yeah.
Every time I drive by it, I think of you. And we should go to that Wingstop that's there.
Yeah, the Wingdome.
A Wingdome.
Yeah.
Because I doubt... I was driving by it like a week ago and I was like, oh, it'd be fun to go to the Wingdome. And I looked at Stacy. I was like, you probably wouldn't want to go there. I should probably go there with someone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's kind of a, it's not the sort of place that she would like to eat at and or even be at, I think. Because it's kind of dive bar-ish.
It is kind of divey.
Yeah. Like they sell those, you know, so it's a wing, a chicken wing.
Chicken wings.
So they have like different... You know, hot wings or you know you can get super hot wings and this was before the whole trend. This was this place was around 20-30 years ago
and the Kingdome was around. That's why it's called the Wingdome.
Oh really?
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Yeah, it was clever back then.
But so it's a local thing.
Yeah.
Huh. Anyway, so in this restaurant they serve beer and I think maybe wine, but a lot of beer. You know, beer and wings in a sports bar, you watch games.
Yeah.
And instead of a pitcher, which is what normal sports bars will do, they'll, you know, if you're there with five buddies, you get a couple pitchers, yeah. and it's easier than going to the bar and getting like right. five glasses of beer every yeah. every bit of time. But instead of a pitcher, they have this cylinder, like think of like a beaker in chemistry class, but it's giant. And there are all these little spigots off the bottom. Do you remember this?
No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they still have it, but yeah. they did back then. It was essentially a see-through keg that they would fill. And they were huge and would contain copious, you know.
Like 10 ounce. Pints or?
I don't know. Yeah, but it yeah. was it was deceptive. I remember seeing them. They like, yeah, you know, that's kind of convenient, I guess. And then you hear the amount of glass, how many pints of beer are in each one of those cylinders. You're like, oh my God,
yeah.
that's a ton of liquid. Anyway, so we should go there sometime. Is
yeah,
my point.
Agreed.
But so then, because I'm curious, I don't know why I'm drilling now, and maybe some recent grads are interested in this sort of thing, but, you know, because there's different payment plans for the loans.
Uh-huh.
And in the very beginning for me, I could only afford the interest. There's a payment plan where if you demonstrated you were poor enough, you didn't have to pay on the principal,
no.
but you did have to pay the interest, yeah. which I think was like 6.5% or something.
Mine was 2%.
Oh. Well, anyway, that's nice.
Yeah.
So were you able to pay on the principal?
No.
Okay.
I was on that income contingent, and I was still on income contingent when me and Colleen met, and then when we were together...
So you were paying...
No. So I was in that condo 2.5 years, not 1.5 years.
That makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, that does.
So
yeah.
you had 40 grand in debt upon graduation,
yeah.
and you still had 40 grand in debt 5 or 6 years later.
38 grand by the time I actually could pay it off.
And okay.
the only reason
that makes more sense.
Yeah. The only reason I paid it off is because Seattle real estate is stupid, appreciates stupidly fast.
Right.
And so when I sold the condo... when we moved into our first house, I made so much money that I could actually write a check. And
oh, that really...
I don't blame you.
That makes me so angry.
Oh, yeah.
I had to work my ass
you
off.
You did. You totally did. You were done yours in, five years, 3 years?
Well, I have it actually. I can actually search. I have a picture, and I think I've labeled it debt. yeah. 3 years to the month.
80 grand in 3 years is insane when yeah. you still have to, you know, pay rent and eat.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is pretty interesting, you know,
yeah,
that I was able to do that. And you know, in like today's dollars, eight, what, yeah. how much is 80 grand?
Oh, it's gotta be double.
Inflation calculator. I will go to Bureau of Labor Statistics, $80,000. Oh, it's funny. I've already done this because it auto filled because it's like you've already asked this question. So in 1997 dollars for today is $155,000. So yeah, in today's double. World, my God, 155. And I was earning $13 an hour at my yeah. agency job.
Yeah,
and yeah.
And then teaching, which was yeah. Something.
I mean, the bottom line is I remember half of my monthly income was going to my debt.
Yeah,
half.
Yeah,
and I meaning that I kept my expenses very low.
You
I
did.
Had very very, you know, humble
yeah.
places that I was living in. My car had 300,000 miles
right.
on it and had a whole
yeah,
literally
it was an
I could Acura. I could see yeah it had it looked good but I could see the road
right
in the footwell when passengers got in. I told them to not.
Here's
not put their
step.
Foot through the floor because their foot would come off.
Yeah,
and I went to Value Village. I went to a secondhand store and
right.
bought shirts for 50 cents and
right.
You know all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and I remember going to McDonald's one day as a treat and thinking that it was way too expensive. I was I can't afford
wow.
this.
You were really
yeah. I remember just like. I was like, I shouldn't be wasting my money yeah. going to McDonald's, you know.
But 3 years?
Yeah.
I mean, it
well,
would take me...
I'm so compulsive. I don't understand, because you're pretty compulsive about this stuff, too.
Well, you become compulsive if you have a little money, but you don't have any. I didn't accrue debt.
It didn't hang over your head the whole time.
Oh yeah, I hated it.
Yeah,
and I I'd live pretty cheap myself. I was living within my means. I was paying my loan down. I didn't have any other. I didn't have to car payment. I didn't do any. You know, I was earning enough basically to cover my monthly expenses and no more.
Yeah.
So $11.40 an hour is about $23,000.
Yeah.
It would have taken me 4 years just to earn $80,000.
Yeah.
You know, so
if you had a sugar mama paying all your bills or something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No. So I got lucky is what happened to me, and I'm grateful, very grateful.
And you got out of that condo just before the crash, a couple of years before the crash.
That is a fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another lucky thing.
Another lucky thing.
Yes. A luck that I did not share with you.
Oh, well, I got trounced in the crash just in a different part of the city. Yeah. Because we sold our Wedgwood house.
When?
Right in 2008.
Oh,
2010. We sold it in 2010.
Yeah, I sold 2010. Well, it took until 2010 to sell my house.
Yeah.
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 My very small, humble little crappy house. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was fine.
We could have been neighbors. Oh, that's right, because I was moving in when you were moving out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you moved in 2010 to that house.
August.
Interesting. Huh. Yeah, we could have been neighbors. I used to walk by your house. That was you were right by, you were along my walking route that I did.
Right.
Anyway, so why did we go on that? Homework.
Homework with the credit card.
Oh, right.
God, that's
okay. Okay. So let's say a client comes to me, who is having some troubles. Say it's a therapist who is having troubles with paying their loans, and I might tell them, well, here's what I did, and here's some things you might try, or here's gigs you might look into. I would absolutely do that. But I would never assign something. You know, I would never go, go home, make a plan, bring it to me. That's more of a business manager or a supervisor.
Right.
As a therapist, not only would that not occur to me, but if it did, I would definitely flag it in my mind as like, no. I might even say to them, you know, I have an impulse right now to kind of act like I'm your supervisor and really give you, or your father or something, like sit down with you and write out a whole business plan. But I'm your therapist, and so maybe find someone to help you with that, or do that on your own. But I think those kinds of explorations would be good for you. Would you like to talk about exploring those with me? You know, if it generated from them, if they like, I would like to talk about my business plan. I'd be like, go for it.
Yeah.
But I would never, I don't know, impose or insert or assign or.
It does. It's usurping the agenda, and that can be that's a disservice.
Right. Even if I'm assigning homework, I mean, assigning homework in general, I don't do for all these reasons. Even if it was, I want you to think about your emotions this week. I will say things like that, but I don't expect them to do it.
I don't expect anybody to do any homework.
Yeah, because I don't want to have that kind of role with these folks, you know?
Yeah, the last thing anybody needs is to come back the next week and think that they're going to get graded for whether or not they performed. And
yeah. You know, I mean, people almost never do the homework.
They almost never do homework.
So what's, anyway.
Well, the world is divided into them that don't, which is like 98% of us, and then that do, which is like 2% of us who do it to a T, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And either direction is reason to not assign homework.
That is a fact.
But first, Bob, let's take a break before we go on with this topic. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, we're back from the break. Going on with anonymous patient, she says, instead, my therapist proceeded to give me homework assignment, which entailed applying for a balance transfer credit card. Mm. I expressed that I didn't really want to focus on solutions and logistics.
Oh, good for you.
With absolute confidence and certainty, they said, you have a good credit score. They want you to apply for this card. It will be a very quick turnaround. So, chiming in here, it sounds like this client is at the very least giving some pushback or overtly saying, I don't really want to talk about solutions. If I heard that from a client, I mean, I would really go, oh, Kirk, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Because that is completely antithetical to me and what I consider to be what therapy is for.
Agreed.
So if I heard anything in that direction of like, yeah, I'm not really here to talk about solutions, I'd be like, Kirk, and I would immediately, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. I would even say, even if I thought I wasn't doing that, I would say, I am so sorry that I gave you the impression that is like completely counter to what I think is good. And when I'm in your shoes, I hate it when people do that shit to me.
Yeah.
So thank you for pointing
out. I like that.
Yeah. So the fact that, or the story anyway, the narrative from Anna's patron is they push back and then the therapist says, well, you have good credit score. They want you to apply for this card. Mm. It's a very quick turnaround. I mean, it sort of implies that maybe the client was saying something like, I don't know if this would work or something. Because yeah. It sounds like the therapist was countering some sort of hesitancy or
right.
or insecurity about you getting a credit card or something. I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, going on. They then went on to coach me on how and where to get a personal loan.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of markers of specificity, right?
Yeah.
Of like, yeah. I mean, at the very least, if you're a therapist, you should check in with your client and say like, is this what you want to talk about? Going on. They even suggested that they write me a letter of recommendation to the bank they use. I said that seemed like a dual relationship or a conflict of interest.
Right on.
So again, even if it was a subtle discussion from the client about a dual relationship, that should be a pretty big indicator to stop and think if you're a therapist.
Yes.
Going on. They said it wasn't an ethical issue because they would give the letter directly to the bank as opposed to giving me the letter to give to the bank.
Well, they were mixing their ethical apples and oranges.
Right. That's backwards.
Yeah.
By giving the letter to the client would have the power to either give or not give,
right.
to break confidentiality and go straight to the bank. Then, I mean, unless there's an ROI, but... Yeah.
But the client is not saying about confidentiality, they're saying about dual relationship, and the therapist just blows by that, at least according to the email.
Oh, I see what you're saying, right? Yeah. They're not talking about confidentiality, right? So a dual relationship. So it's not an ethical issue because I'm giving it. Yeah, that doesn't... It doesn't matter who you give the letter to. The dual relationship, it's signed by you.
Yeah.
So, and is it a dual relationship? Yeah, I suppose so. You're both a therapist and like a financial friend or something.
Yeah.
Because even a financial advisor wouldn't necessarily do that, right?
That's true.
An advisor would advise. They wouldn't vouch for you. So you're essentially becoming like
a
friend or something. But right. I don't know. Like, there's a world, as I say that out loud, there's a world in which a therapist, so if a client came to me and asked me to write a letter along these lines and I could conceivably write a letter, you know, like, if they wanted me to write a letter to speak to how hard they're working in therapy on financial trauma, for example, I could conceivably write that letter. I typically will make sure that it's in the best interest of not only the client, but also in my best interest, because I don't want to be sued for vouching for someone that I don't know if what I'm vouching for is something to vouch for. Plus, I don't want to get into that kind of dual role anyway, where there's this expectation that whenever they run into a barrier, they can ask me for that kind of practical help. You know, it's just not really what I feel is best for the client, you know?
Yeah.
If they want to talk about how they can build those relationships in their real life, then absolutely. But, you know, I've done that sort of thing before. And so it could be along those lines, but the client isn't asking for it.
Right.
The client is actively saying, I don't know about this.
I don't want solutions, they're saying.
Yeah. Now, you said earlier, we weren't there. It's possible that the client said something like, well, isn't that a dual relationship issue? And the therapist says, no, you know, instead of what the client is saying is, I said that seemed like a dual relationship or conflict of interest. That sounds more assertive. And so, you know, especially given the fact that this client says that they've been working together for 5 years and really like this therapist. But there is a risk, but just going out with the email.
Yeah.
Now I'm going back through the years and thinking of examples of times when I felt like something they said didn't feel right, but I ignored my gut feeling and followed their advice, only to find that I was probably right to be hesitant. I went to grad school. I went to the grad school they suggested because they had a former student and teacher there. Hmm. They had also suggested I wear a particular kind of stone for its magical properties, and I went ahead and spent a stupid amount of money on rocks. Stupid is as stupid does, I know. I acknowledge my part in this. So just chiming in here. So I don't know if you're quoting the movie Forrest Gump or you're quoting me, but that's not my weird definition of stupid is stupid does, because I think what you're saying, Anonymous Patron, is you're the stupid one, yeah. And because you've done stupid things, you continue to do stupid things. That is not, you're a client.
Yeah.
And the stupid is a stupid does can never apply to a client.
It cannot.
It can only apply to a therapist. So if we want to apply the principle or the indictment or the philosophy is that, the prediction, I guess, the profile, it's a statement of a profile. It's like, if you see a behavior that is well beyond the standard of practice and is, highly questionable at the very least, then it's usually the tip of the iceberg, because what led someone to that behavior is the bigger problem leads them to do all sorts of shit that is a problem. Anyway, so, and we're hearing that with this therapist. Yeah, there seems to be like a lot of overt advice giving. Now, can a therapist, and I've had this before, I've had clients while in therapy with me make the discovery that they want to become a therapist themselves. I'm always a little worried because they might really love therapy and they just want to absorb the whole thing. They're really enjoying it. And is it really what they want, or is it just their desire to kind of consume more of therapy instead of actually becoming a therapist? And yeah. I've seen that before too. But sure. Of course, a lot of therapists, me included, sort of, will be inspired to become a therapist when they're in therapy.
Right.
Dear listener, I don't know if you can hear that buzz sound, but I think someone is either chainsawing a tree or they're running like a drone or something. So it's not
wood chipper.
It's not your head. You don't have tinnitus.
Right.
It's something going on. Anyway, so, or tinnitus, sometimes I hear people say tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Yeah. What do they say?
They say tinnitus. I've always said tinnitus, but yeah. I don't know what it is.
So let's take another break.
Yeah.
All right, we're back from the break. So let's do another OPP. What do you say?
Oh, nuts.
These people became patrons all the way back in 2021 as well. We have Fong from Sydney, Australia. We have, these are all monthly patrons. We have Seth from Toronto, Guy from Toronto, or Guy. Because Toronto, is that in Quebec?
No, I think it's further
west. Montreal.
Montreal.
Okay. So yeah. Toronto, someone named Guy would be Guy, not Guy.
Probably, but.
Right? Who knows? Lucy from Great Britain, Victoria from Sweden, and Naima from also the same town in Sweden, from Uppsala. Both wow. Victoria and Naima. Do you know each other, the two of you? That would be interesting. Mm-hmm. Olivia from Ontario, Shanice from Alberta, Canada, Jenna from Winnipeg, Canada. Winnipeg, MB. What province is MB?
M, like Mary?
MB, yeah. MB, California, or Canada, California.
Is it New Brunswick? But
I guess that was Winnipeg. Did this, or Winnipeg and no, M, as in Mary. MB,
Canada. I don't know what it is.
MB, Canada, province. Oh, Manitoba.
Oh, golly.
You always forget about Manitoba. Do you not? I do.
The Manitobans are not happy about it.
I know, but I know Quebec, I know Ontario, I know Saskatchewan, Alberta, BC, of course, but you don't hear about Manitoba. And of course, Winnipeg is the big city in Manitoba.
Don't they have a hockey team?
I don't know. Okay. I mean, I'm sure,
yeah,
but maybe not an NHL one. Oh. Anyway, the following patrons, we don't know where they live because they didn't mention, which is fine. So we have Christine, Stephanie, Terracotta, Taylor, Risa, Aaron, Emma, Lauren, Farida, and Alex, all from God knows where. Thank you for becoming a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin. All right. Going on. I'm second guessing their judgment and my judgment for having trusted them so many times. I know some of this is transference from my childhood, and I'm reacting to a familiar feeling of, oh no, the adults don't know how to handle anything. I'm not safe. Okay. So that seems to point to maybe the financial trauma of parents that had very irresponsible financial behaviors that would put her in a very unsafe place. So she's saying that I know some of this is transference, meaning like I am underneath this therapist's care, and this therapist is kind of like a parent to me, I feel safe with them, and they are guiding me about how to be responsible, how I can shake the shackles of my parents and all their irresponsible financial decisions. And I am starting, I mean, to expand it, I don't know if you're talking about some honest patron, but you're starting to go into your material of financial trauma. You said that rather recently you decided to open that can of worms, which will cause regression and more transference to your therapist in all likelihood.
Right.
And so it's possible that, so there's a couple stories here. Well, what do you think is happening here?
I think the therapist has lost sight of their treatment goal and their treatment alliance, just based on what's been written here, and owes this person an apology and a course correction. They're saying that they are sort of re-evaluating therapy and, you know, questioning in retrospect the blind way in which they accepted the therapist's influence and advice, and they're rethinking about that. So that tells us that they're not happy with what's going on now, that's for sure. I couldn't say if those past moments were, you know, you should have done something different or even would necessarily have regret. It's sort of confounded by the fact that therapists have power and influence. They just do. Therefore, that's why we should be very careful and mindful and constantly checking with our clients. Like, I end every session with, how did we do today? And even then, it's still a high demand situation, because it'd be hard to say to somebody, well, you know, you were focused on all the wrong stuff today. But it is at least an invitation. And if somebody said that to me, oh, you bet I'd listen.
But I don't ask that question every time.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing since you do ask that question every time, you'll see some people who seem to hesitate, which says something, right? Or they don't have the kind of light, airy way they might say it otherwise. You know, they'll be like, yeah, this today was good. Instead, they're like, I think today was good. And you detect that and you're like, oh, is there hesitation? You know, even though they are placating due to the demand or their insecurity or something, it's hard to not indicate something. Yeah. It's like the old premise of, in customer service, if you get, you know, on a Likert scale from 1 to 5, if you get a 4, that means something went wrong. You know what I mean? Because it's so easy to give a 5 because if everything went well, according to expectations, you tend to give a 5.
Right.
Depending on the definition of the Likert scale.
Right.
You're not necessarily looking for 1s and 2s. Obviously,
you might get them, but.
Yeah, but 3s and 4s. There's something there, some at least a conversation potentially,
right?
Anyway, so yeah, it sounds like the therapist has lost the thread and also the working alliance.
Yeah,
so I think there's a number of possibilities here. One, anonymous patron, if I was to be the most charitable to your therapist, which I think is absolutely possible, I'm not saying this is a remote chance of this being the narrative, is that, and I'm basing this charitable narrative on the fact that you enjoyed 5 years of good therapy and you're a therapist in training yourself, so you kind of know the deal, which tells me that there's not a good chance that this therapist has been like this charismatic cult leader that's been pulling the strings and you've just been haplessly following along. It doesn't seem likely to be the main theme. Now, might there be moments of that? Yeah. So in this charitable story, you The therapist is still basically trustworthy. There has been a rupture, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's something to alert your therapist to, and your therapist needs to correct for that in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. One, just apologize for the several incidents, but also recognizing that their tendency to give advice in general, maybe to a lot of clients, they wouldn't necessarily talk about this, but it is misguided and not necessarily helpful. You know, suggesting that you buy a magical rock, you know, that kind of stuff, when you're not on board with it, what's wrong with you? that can all be present, but still the relationship is safe and the client is good enough to repair the rupture and hear you. And what happened was, as you were and maybe before you opened a can of worms of the financial trauma to yourself, there were, you know, a dozen incidents where maybe you were, like the rock thing, you were going along with your therapist's advice or suggestion, maybe a little bit more than you would have otherwise. Maybe your therapist was being a little too advice giving, and those aren't great incidents, but the overall picture is there was a lot of freedom and a lot of honoring of your agency and your autonomy. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the point where you start to open the can of worms of your financial trauma. And it's, there's a, as you say, anonymous patron, there's a lot of unsafety there. There's a lot of fear and maybe a lot of anger, a lot of resentment of incompetent leaders of your life.
Yeah.
And then, she starts to, or I don't know the gender, you didn't say the gender of the therapist, so I don't know, but your therapist starts to give you advice in the normal kind of way that they might do. But in the beginning of the session, the therapist might kind of throw something out there, and then you actually react. If we had a video camera inside, you're like, I don't know about this, but the outside of it, the perception from the therapist might have been very different, because you might have gone to a place of transference where you succumbed or pleased or downplayed your own alarm bells or whatever, and the way you came across was obscured by that.
Yeah.
And your therapist just didn't pick up on
that. Dismissed it.
Yeah. And thought you were on board.
Right.
You might have even looked more on board than you would have otherwise because of the regression that you might have been going through. I don't know if that was happening.
Which is a possibility.
Yeah. And of course, you revisit this and you repair it and you, of course, correct. It's a great opportunity for a lot of things, not only your own growth, but also for the therapist to maybe shift at least the therapy with you, maybe therapy with a lot of people.
Maybe.
Not that you're responsible for that administration. But so that's one narrative. Another, and I think that's a distinct possibility. Mm-hmm. Another narrative is that on the maybe the most uncharitable perspective is that your therapist from the beginning has a problem of either narcissism or needing to dominate. Codependency is another issue of their own traumas regarding needing to fix other people's problems, anxiety about other people having issues, and a mandate that they will be the one to fix it. And they need to take the shortest route from A to B,
right.
Which means to dominate other people and to tell them what to do and kind of pressure them to do things. So they had that quality. And you, client, if that's true, had the opposite quality of underfunctioning and dependency. Maybe the relational or the financial trauma is a part of that. But the fact that for 5 years you didn't really notice anything, if that was happening, would point to some blind spot for you, which is not your fault. It's the therapist's fault.
Yeah.
But the dynamic was there. And then when you get into the financial trauma issue, it really focuses you on things and you start to question things. And then all of a sudden you look back historically on your relationship and you see this dynamic of overfunctioning, underfunctioning, or codependency and dependency, or cult leader and follower, or dominator and dominated. Like it that's possible. I don't think that's a high likelihood, but it is possible, or at least in that direction. So that's another story.
Yeah. And
I guess there's a lot of stories in between there. You know, some I guess those are the two ends of the spectrum that I'm right. thinking of, right? Let's like, can you degrees. Think of another?
I can't, but you could think, imagine degrees of
right.
one or both,
yeah.
you know, coming up in this or that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think a lot hinges on if you do have any kind of dependency issues, meaning that you have a schema that you're going to screw things up unless you hand over your agency and your autonomy to someone else. And you tend to attract codependent overfunctioners who tell you what to do. But this is a very common dynamic, I have to say, for the codependent and underfunctioner, in that the underfunctioner will have, you know, very intense periods and episodes of deep anger towards the overfunctioner, but long stretches of time where they've consciously very much appreciate the overfunctioner fixing their problems because they need that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it is a very common counter transference problem within therapy because, of course, clients coming to us for help, that's what they do.
Right.
And we want to be helpful.
Right.
And we tend to be on the overfunctioner codependent side of things as therapists because that's what led us to this profession. And if and a lot of therapists, anecdotally in my experience, they don't even know what dependent personality disorder is. and they have a misguided understanding of what codependency is, and they might not even have been trained in systems theory where you understand the notion of how two-person systems can go down a certain road where they both are to blame for the dance that eventually results in the overfunctioning, underfunctioning. So, you know, it's worrisome to me. I mean, if we're often ranting and raving about people not being aware of borderline, I mean, God help dependent people, because that's not even on the list of things that people know that they... yeah. I bet you there are whole swaths of therapists and clinicians who, if I asked them to describe what dependent personality disorder was, they would not have any idea. They wouldn't even know where to begin.
I wouldn't know.
The last time they even were exposed to it maybe was in graduate school when they had 1 week to study literally every personality disorder in the DSM.
Yeah.
And they read the criteria right. and they moved on. There yeah. was some PowerPoint where they talked about it and they moved on anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's possible that, so you would have to ask yourself, anonymous patron, do you have a tendency for dependency and underfunctioning and looking for codependent people? Because if that's true, then that does raise a red flag for this dynamic having been around a long time without yeah. your therapist noting it or you noting it.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that tendency, then you would have detected something. You know, like for me, I'm not dependent. I don't have that. I don't have anything close to that. When I take all the tests, like I'm nowhere on that spectrum at all.
Yeah.
And if I had a therapist who was giving me over advice from day one for 5 years, especially, like it would annoy me.
Yeah.
I would note it. I don't know what I'd do about it, but
you'd probably say something at some point.
I don't know. It depends. You know, it depends.
Okay.
I imagine I've had therapists that I liked that would do stuff kind of in this camp, and I would just let it go.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a very confrontational person.
But you would have
noted something about my transference issues, actually, because I am confrontational in other contexts, but not with my therapists. Anyway, were you going to say something?
Yeah, but now it just flew out of my head. I can't believe it.
You looked like you were going to say something.
I was going to say something, and then, honest to God, I just...
Sorry.
Yeah.
I interrupted you.
No, you're all right.
So anyway, that's the last little bit of the email is, anyway, is it common for therapists to blur these lines when the client is also a therapist? What do you think?
I don't think that dynamic has anything to do with it. Right. The line could get blurred, but I don't think it's because of that.
Well,
like, the theory is that, you know, we're also collegial. Is that the idea? Is that the blurry?
Yeah. Yeah. At first I was like, no, this doesn't really have anything to do. But then I think, well, it could, because I have seen this, and I guess I've felt it myself, is that when, so say I have a client that comes
yeah.
in, they tell me they're a therapist,
right.
then it feels like kind of disrespectful to not at least offer up a little bit of a divergence at times from the conversation. You know, like if we were talking about you know, say they're coming to me for relational trauma recovery and I'm talking with them, I might say, well, I'm sure you know this, because I wouldn't want to insult them by explaining something. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I might say something like, well, you're a therapist. Like, what would you do to help yourself? I mean, that wouldn't be a bad question to ask. But anyway, I would, there would be an extra bit to therapy that wouldn't necessarily be present.
Mm-hmm.
I might also, if I was intimidated or insecure, I might try to bond with them as a colleague, I guess, as a way, a shortcut, as a way to try to shortcut my insecurity or something. You know, I could see that.
Yeah. You're saying the therapist might bond with their client. Their therapist client.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that therapists might be insecure.
Yeah.
Because they're. I didn't say this. So, what I'm trying to say is that therapists often will feel insecure when they have a therapist as a client.
Yeah.
And that insecurity has to be dealt with somehow. Right. And some therapists might try to muddy the waters with therapy. You know, you could see a therapist saying.
Yeah.
To themselves, or you could see a therapist saying to themselves, I need to fix their problems as fast as possible because that's what they're here for. And because of their anxiety, they overlook their therapeutic judgment. You know, you could see that.
I could see that.
Yeah. But, I mean, how many therapists have you had as a client?
Maybe 10.
Yeah. And did you ever run into anything?
Oh, yeah. I was, for the first 15 years of working, that's a guess on the time, I was very nervous to work with therapists. Some of them were in my skills class.
What were you nervous about?
These kinds of things. It's like, how do I appear to them? Do I seem competent? I sort of felt a need to demonstrate that I knew what I was doing. And I don't know how it leaked out in my behavior. I just know that I could feel my heart rate go up when I knew I was going to be seeing someone who was also doing very similar work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't really care. I mean, no, I should restate that. That is not entirely true. I think now I want to be cautious about making any presumptions about how things are for my therapist client and not get stuck in believing that because they're a therapist, they know X. I don't want to presume that they don't know it. And I certainly, if I sounded pedantic, I would definitely apologize. But I don't want to presume I know anything about the work life of people whose work life I have no information about. And
meaning you don't want to go too fast for them.
Yeah.
Thinking that.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cause I'm not really talking about their job. But in general, I actually like working with therapists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I wonder about my, you know, how many, I've had a lot of therapists. I wonder what the experience of me has been. If people have felt intimidated mm-hmm. by me simply because
have you ever thought that or detected that your therapist was intimidated by you?
I haven't detected that from my therapist.
Not your current, but because he doesn't seem like he's, and if he were to be, I'm sure he has a whole emotional process that he walks through. He seems like the pinnacle of that awareness and work. But other therapists in the past?
I just don't know. And I could imagine me with my own dependency needs not being able to detect, mm-hmm. you know, what's up for somebody else.
You know, I don't know if I ever thought about this. I did have a therapist briefly because I didn't like him. And I thought he had such a weird style. And although I could see why people would like him because he had the appearance of someone that was a good listener and his office was very cozy and serene and almost like a nook in the woods or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But in the end, I felt like he was not listening to me. He had the appearance of someone that was listening, but when he would reflect or ask questions, I'd be like, huh? What is that?
Uh-huh.
And I stuck with him for about 5 sessions and then just said, I think I'll take a break. And then I found someone else that actually was a good listener. But so it's possible that he was thrown off. But I don't know. He was so far off, though.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But I'm trying to think for myself if I was ever... I think another aspect of the way that I cope with it is I just try not to think about it because it throws me off.
Yeah.
And the I can't think of a time where a therapist came to me for therapy and they really wanted to talk about the fact that they were a therapist. You know, I think, like for yourself, for ourselves,
right?
I think I have thought when I would go for an initial session with a therapist, I think I even contemplated not telling him I was a therapist because I didn't want to be treated differently.
Yeah.
I want to get the full Monty, if you will.
Yeah.
I want to be treated with care.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want them to think, well, he's a therapist, so I don't need to,
right.
I don't need to bring my A game, you know, which is another side of it, right? Of like, you'd think, well, you'd be intimidated to bring your A plus game, but you could see another therapist. Maybe this is what this anonymous patron's getting at, where the therapist is like, well, you know, she's a therapist. She's okay. I don't need to work hard. She's not at risk of anything. And right. so I can kind of let my guard down and start having a lot of dual relationships. Cause you know, we're colleagues and that kind of thing, you know, you could see a therapist doing that kind of thing. So if I had that impulse to not tell a therapist that I was a therapist, I think it is, according to what the anonymous patron is getting at, possible.
Possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I want to be treated as Bob.
Yeah.
Not as
the therapist that's a client. Yeah.
Because when it comes to therapy, I mean, some of my trauma is pre-verbal, so it doesn't really matter what I do for a living.
Right.
It's just, and, you know, I need someone that can walk with that. Doesn't really, none of it fucking matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me as a client, I can become intellectual as a problem to a fault. And if I'm in therapy colleague mode, then it's guaranteed that that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Whereas if I just think of myself as a human being,
right.
then it's much less likely to happen.
Right.
Not that it wouldn't, but, so the last bit of the email, am I overreacting and holding this therapist to too high a standard? And I basically answered that earlier. It's hard to know, but you are the client, anonymous patron. So you can be a stupid as a stupid does. So let's say there's a world in which you are overreacting, but that is okay.
Yeah.
So just go for it. Your therapist should be able to handle it. Even if you're wrong, even if you're convinced for 6 months that your therapist was overstepping and your therapist was giving too much advice, even if you're objectively wrong, which probably isn't true.
Probably not.
You have the 100% right to be able to just, be in that space and to assert that and to explore that. Maybe in a couple of years, you'll look back and think, oh, yeah, I was kind of going through something. But unless you actually assert yourself and bring it to the table, then you're not doing yourself any favors. And secondarily, you're not helping your therapist understand what's happening. The last sentence, thank you both so much, you and Bob, for your time and consideration and for the very important work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, that's nice.
That's nice.
All right, Bob, let's adjourn there. And tune in next time when we continue reading your emails. By the way, if you want the email to come to us, you want to say, hey, Kirk and Bob, Stacy, when she reads those emails, puts them in the Google Doc that we look at, or I look at, and that's a little tip for you. And it goes for any of the co-hosts, by the way, if it's Berto or Becca or just me or whatever. And everyone, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.